This is Back to Back.
Yo, what's up, Back to Backers? This is Willie Joy. Welcome to the show. This is Back to Back. It's my podcast. How you doing out there? How you feeling? I've got Henry Fong on the show today. One of my favorite people, man. I love this guy so much. And he's got a brand new song coming out this week, this Friday, on Dimmock Records. The song is called Jump Up. It's got all the DJs going crazy right now. It's one of my favorite records of the moment. You got to grab that when it drops. He's been on a tear. The last song he put out, called Rave Tool, is getting played by all the biggest names in the game. And that's one of the things I love about Henry Fong, man. He's such a chameleon. He can make music in any style, but it still sounds like him. Endlessly creative. Such a good dude. I'll set the scene for you of how we met up in a second. I feel insane right now. I played a show last night with Yemi too, and man, we just went in. I haven't had a night like that in a while. We both did separate sets, and then we closed the night by doing a long back-to-back for like 3 hours. So, you know, between the two separate sets and then our back-to-back, we were DJing for like 6 hours. It was at U Street Music Hall in Washington, D.C., one of the best venues in the country, and it was one of the most fun sets I did this whole year. We shut the club down, we reopened the club, we did an after party, we were there till like 6 in the morning. It's been a while since I really went in like that, but the vibe was just too good, man. We couldn't stop. I love those kind of nights. They're rare. You don't know when they're gonna happen, but when they do, I mean, that's it, man. That's the shit. That's why we all keep coming back to it. But you can probably hear I'm a little haggard right now. It was worth it. So whatever you did this week, whatever stretches you made, man, I hope it was worth it. You got to pick your spots. And you know what? We picked a good one. Even before the club, yeah, me too and I, we met up. You know, we go way, way, way back to the old Chicago days. I mean, I've known him as long as I've known basically anyone who's a DJ. So we met up, we saw the Joker movie before the club. Amazing movie. I loved it. And so front to back, by the end of the night, I mean, we had been hanging out for like 12 hours, something ridiculous. But man, what a great night. I would be remiss if I did not mention that Back to Back is brought to you today by Serato. I love using Serato's products. I've used them my whole career. I love working with them. We've collaborated on a few different projects. But listen, one of the most exciting things they've done is one of their newest projects, and it is a piece of software called Serato Studio. All my producers out there, listen up. You need to go check this out. Serato Studio is a new beat-making tool that helps you simplify the path to music production. So whether you're a beginner or an expert producer, Serato Studio is here to simplify your workflow, get the creativity flowing, and to help you avoid all those annoying technical roadblocks that we all hit from time to time. And look, to be clear, they're not trying to replace your main DAW. Serato Studio, you can get in there, you can make a project really fast, get your ideas out, get it onto paper, and then you can export stems from there into any DAW you want, wherever you're most comfortable. And it comes built in with tons of features, loops, effects, sample packs. You got to go check them out. And right now, if you do, there's a free 14-day trial of Serato Studio just waiting for you. So go to www.serato.com/studio and get it now. You got nothing to lose. It's yours for free for 2 weeks. That's www.serato.com/studio. All right. So for this chat with Henry Fong, I met up with him on my last trip to LA. I went over to his house and we sat in his studio. He has a really sweet new dog that he just rescued that is huge and super powerful looking, but was just terrified of me the whole time. so terrified that it wouldn't even leave the room we were recording in because it would have to walk by me. It was adorable. And it was so good to catch up with Henry. We don't get to talk that much, but every time we do, I just leave feeling positive, smiling. He's got such a good energy. So it was great to just catch up with him, find out what's been going on with him, what he's been working on. He's got a really interesting career path, and hands down, I mean, I don't even know who else would be in this category, but hands down, the best dreadlocked surfing DJ that I know. He's always innovating. His music really just sounds like him. It doesn't sound like anybody else. And if you've listened to the show before, you know that's just one of my favorite things. So listen, I'm a little loopy. I didn't get much sleep last night. I'm just going to let you guys enjoy this because we had a great time. I do want to give a quick shout out to everybody who's been putting up posts, letting people know about this show, spreading the word of mouth. And look, the way that I get to keep making this show every single week, the way I get to keep it free for everybody, keep getting awesome guests to share with all you guys, all of that comes from your support. And look, it's really easy, actually, for you to be a good Samaritan and help this podcast out. All you have to do is let other people know you're listening. I'm always going to be replying, reposting whatever you put up there. So let people know, man. And make sure to tag me. I'm at Willie Joy on all social media. The show is at Back to Back Pod. So do your good deed for the day. It's free. It takes about 10 seconds. And just let your friends know what you're listening to. Let them know what we're up to over here at Back to Back. And once again, a big shout out to everybody who's posting up every single week. I love seeing it, man. And I'm telling you, there is no better way to help support this show. I'm always here for you too. Don't forget, you can always email me at backtobackpod@gmail.com. If you have thoughts about the show, if there are guests you want to hear from, if something we said in a past episode gave you some ideas or you have some questions, you can always write in. I reply to every single email, basically. Sometimes it takes me a few days, but I see it, I'm gonna read it, I'm gonna hit you back, and that's it, man. Connecting with you guys, that's what it's all about. So that's my little spiel. We're gonna get into today's episode right now. I hope you like this one, so check it out. This is me and Henry Fong, Back to Back. Let's go. When did you leave Orange County? Because you were there for a while.
Yeah, I was in Orange County. I was in Newport that was the first place I moved when I left Florida. And then I came there in end of 2012, I think. I lived there for a year or two.
Okay.
I was living with my mother-in-law and they had a spare bedroom.
Sounds kind of intense.
Yeah. I was just like, man, here I am like in my mid-20s and I'm like living with a mom again. I'm like, what? So, but it was good because it let me kind of get my feet together and get my shit together before like the whole music thing took off. Like,
yeah,
I had time to just work on music all day because I was just like super cheap.
Oh yeah, man. I mean, I always tell super young producers who are just coming up, like, as long as you can stay living in your parents' basement, do it as long as you can.
Like, not a bad idea.
Yeah. Like, as long as they're cool with it and you're cool with it, like, there's no shame in it.
Yeah.
Because the second you pop out into the quote-unquote real world here, the pressure gets so much worse.
Oh, yeah. So I stayed there for like a year or so and then moved to right smack dab in the middle of Hollywood.
Mm.
Had to do that whole thing. Did the Hollywood thing. Stayed there for a year. And I was like, this is too hectic. And then I actually, like, I started meeting more people. I started doing studio sessions. That was kind of at the peak of like my year where I started kind of coming up.
Which is what, 2012, 2013?
2013.
Yeah.
And then I just got so sick of Hollywood. I was like, yo, there's cars everywhere, like black dust from all the highway right on my apartment all the time.
Oh,
like,
man.
So I was like, I'm fucking going back to Orange County. So then I moved back to Newport. Because I'm like a surfer and I'm like really like the ocean is my first and foremost thing, even before music. So I was just like, you know, I just want to relax a little bit and I just want to be the dude in Orange County, you know?
Yeah.
So then I kind of became the dude in Orange County. Like I was playing like all those clubs there too.
Yeah.
Like I was playing Yoast and Sutra all the time. And I kind of became known as like the OC guy. And then everyone would hit me up when they came into Orange County. Like I remember the Chainsmokers were coming in. They're like, dude, you live in Orange County, right? You live in Newport. Let's go surf. Can you take a surf? I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. So then I did that for like 2 years or so. And then it became to the point where I was getting more and more sessions, and I was like, now I got to move back to LA. Right. So we moved back to LA and now I'm here.
Right, right, right.
So I've gone back and forth multiple times.
That makes more sense. Because I think the first time we ever met in person was the second time that you had moved back to Orange County.
Yeah, I think so.
And so I remember you were telling me about how nice it is to live out there, that you could go surfing.
Oh, yeah, it was at the Brill Show.
Oh, yeah, was that's that right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. The Twonk the Nation.
Yeah, we came and we were up there just all playing back to back. That was fun.
That was super fun, man. I remember that.
Yost.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good that times. Tour, like, that was a really fun tour because I was on that tour.
Oh, you were on the tour.
Earlier, like a different leg of it. And then randomly, I think I just drove up from San Diego when I saw that they were going to be in Orange County that night.
Oh,
and
okay,
then it
gotcha.
Ended up being that huge back to back. That was really fun. There's still, do you remember, there's like a picture from that night that I see
remember.
Every once in a while.
I just remember I was really sweaty and it was me, you, Ghastly.
Party favor.
Yeah, dude, we were up there just having a blast for like 30 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, that was great.
I just remember Brill's getting up there and he like did this thing where he like played Beastie Boys Intergalactic and he started popping locking on the stage. I was like, holy shit, he's a good dancer.
Dude, people don't know. He was a dancer before he was a musician, kind of.
I remember that now.
Like he was telling me it had like a real dance crew.
Oh,
like they would put out like
really
videos.
Good. So yeah. I get it. That was actually funny. I played one of my first shows ever on tour was with Brills.
Oh, really?
It's like early 2013, me, him, and Lucky Date, we played some event center in McAllen, Texas.
Oh, wow.
Shit was crazy. Crazy.
So that was like the beginning of his like.
Yeah, we kind of, me and him started kind of at the same time and when we started like doing everything together. So me and him were, you know, those DJs that you kind of share the journey together.
Yeah.
And you remember coming up with at the same time. It's like, he's definitely one of those.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of my favorite people, man. I met him right around that time too.
Yeah. You're kind of from that era too, man. You're like 2013
yeah.
era.
Yeah. Around there. And he and I like made music really early on when
yeah,
he
I remember
started
that.
Coming out.
I remember all that trap stuff you guys used to make.
Yeah. 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 And it was just one of those things. Like I'm sure you've worked with people where just, we would sit down and like, we kind of had the same brain, like, you know,
yeah.
His first idea. I was like, yeah, that's a great idea. I would do something. He's like, that's what I was going to, you know, it's that kind of thing. And it's very rare. I haven't found that with a lot of people I've worked with.
Yeah, me neither.
It's weird, man. Well, now he's LS Dream, right? And he's kind of gone through this whole career revival, reinvention.
It's important for artists to do that right now, I think.
I think so too, man. I was going to ask you for where you're at. Usually I ask this kind of more at the end, but you know, everybody goes through waves in this game, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know for you, like you blew up so fast, like out of the gates, right?
The problem with that was I had only been producing for like a couple years, not uh-huh. even. And my production was so... Man, I feel like I wish I could have waited till I had my production dialed in and really had what I wanted to do set before I, you know, I guess blew up or whatever. But yeah, I got popular off the big room stuff.
Yeah.
I was making some electro stuff, but it was the big room wave.
Right.
Like I knew once I heard that big kick drum, I was like, and I knew how good like the early Afrojack, because I used to be like a top 40 club DJ back in Orlando. And I remember as a, you know, top 40 DJ, I could only play like Afrojack, and that was the only, I could play Afrojack and like Steve Aoki, Pursuit of Happiness, and like a handful of dance tunes. And I was slowly, every set, I was trying to incorporate more and more dance. And I just remember the Afrojack stuff was like, oh, I could play it anywhere. And it was going off. And I was like, oh shit. I was like, this stuff is, it's cool because I can play it in to any audience or whatever. So then I kind of took that approach, I guess, with my productions. I started making more like kind of that big room Dutch house sound.
Yeah.
I'd only been producing for like 2 years, man.
Right.
Not even.
So yeah. So you probably didn't even have it.
I didn't even have a chance to figure out what I was doing. I get thrown in the studio with people. I'm like, I don't know how to do anything. Like I could make a song obviously, but it was just so rudimentary.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I would get that way. I still get that way, to be honest. If I'm in the room with somebody that I know is technically like just incredible, because I've never been the technical guy. I'm the guy who sort of hacks it together in this like backwards way that only I understand. And it works really well for me.
Yeah. Same.
But then I'm always kind of weird about showing it to other people because it's just a weird way to do it.
tell me if I'm wrong though, Len, you actually go in the studio with like guys you really look up to and you have this realization, you're like, you know what? They're kind of doing the same shit.
Yeah.
I am. And they're really not doing anything crazy.
It's true.
I remember having that, that epiphany. I think who's in the studio with? I was in the studio with a couple guys early on and like that early. It was Tommy Trash and like Dylan Francis, a couple guys I got in the studio with. And I was like, really kind of intimidated to go in the studio with these guys because these guys are, you know, yeah. I looked up to all their music and stuff and I was big fans of them. I get in the studio with them and I'm like, oh, you know what? They're actually just kind of doing the same shit I am.
Right.
But they have these really fucking well thought out, put together ideas in their head, or they're just so musically inclined. Like Tommy Trash is like, he's a classically trained pianist and trumpet player and he can just get on the keyboard and play some really cool chords. I remember getting in the studio with him. He's like, how about these chords? And I was like, wow. And it wasn't so much what was going on in the Ableton of session. Course. It was just what's going on in their heads.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the piano thing is a whole nother thing. It's such a valuable studio skill that I just don't have.
I just don't have it either. And I feel you on that, man.
Yeah. I mean, and again, I've hacked my way around it, right? Like I can draw in chords like a motherfucker. But
it's I can't play them either, but I can draw them in. It's like, it might take you a couple tries to draw in the MIDI notes, but eventually you'll get it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, I played the trumpet growing up.
You're a trumpet player.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was in a jazz band. Like, I know music theory a little bit, but it's just it's not in my fingertips. You know what I mean? Like, I can't just sit down.
It's just your ear.
Yeah, yeah.
Same, I played a saxophone.
Okay.
I sat like second or third chair in the band.
Nice.
Like sixth, seventh, eighth grade. Yeah, so I just played saxophone and then I just quit and then... If you gave me a piece of sheet music right now, I'd probably like sit there and look at it. Like it'd take me a long time to figure out what was going on.
Yeah. I mean, I can still read.
You can still read music.
I can still read it, but sax is the same way as trumpet. Like you need muscles in your mouth to do
it.
And I've lost all of that. So
trumpet,
you know.
Trumpet is hard, man. I've tried to mess around a couple of times and just there's literally only three keys and the combination of that mixed with the pressure and making the octaves with your mouth is like super, super tough.
That's honestly how I feel about sax, man. And my dad played sax for a while.
Sax, but you have all the keys on the sax and you just like, I feel like if I blow a sax versus blow a trumpet, the trumpet's harder for me. Like, oh.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I mean, I never really gave sax that much effort. So. Yeah. So were you, when you were playing sax and in, you know, middle school and all that, were you in Florida? Is that where you're from originally?
Yeah, I'm from Florida. I've lived there my entire life.
What part of Florida?
South Florida. It's a little town called Jupiter, Florida, which if you're not from Florida, you probably would have no idea where that is.
Wasn't that on a TV show or something? That sounds really familiar.
Yeah, it's been on a couple TV shows. Okay. Maybe it's a little north of West Palm Beach.
Okay.
So all in all, if you're looking at a map, South Florida, it's the very top of South Florida.
Okay.
So South Florida is like Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach, and it's right above West Palm Beach. And after Jupiter is the line for where South Florida basically ends.
Interesting. And what was the vibe there? Was it actually like a small town?
Yeah. There's basically just two main roads that lead to the beach. That are like parallel.
Okay.
And it's a very relaxed, it's a fishing town. Mm. So the thing to do there is everyone gets in their boats on the weekends and you go out fishing and you go to a sandbar and you drink. And it's a very like island style life.
That's
it's like,
amazing.
It's very, the entire city is pretty much based around fishing and or golf. There's like the PGA Tour PGA around that area. So golfing is big, but fishing is kind of like, it's the kind of one of the sport fishing capitals of the world, I guess.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So the entire world, like it's definitely.
So would you get like a lot of tourists in certain seasons?
A lot of people come there for the sail fishing. Actually, the sail fishing is like world class. But yeah, there's a lot of fishing tourists that come there. And then there's another fish called snook. And that is like the popular game fish there. So people come from all over to catch those two things.
That's so interesting. That's like, I think we forget that exists in America. Like a fishing
that's
town.
A very big thing in America, especially like from when I grew up, that's what I did. Mm-hmm. I just went fishing and hunting with my family all the time.
Is that what your parents did? Like, is that why you were living there?
No. So my dad, he actually worked for the military. He worked in the Pentagon, totally different.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he worked in the Pentagon and he retired from there and he was in the Pentagon for like, man, 25 years.
Mm.
So he was doing budgeting for the Air Force.
Okay.
And he was there for all those wars, man.
Wow.
Like Vietnam and all that stuff, Korean War. And he retired.
He tell you stories about that?
Nah, you know what? He never really got too in depth on any of the stories.
Yeah.
One thing he did tell me, I asked him one day, I was like, Dad, tell me about classified stuff. He's just like, Henry, all I can tell you is that they misclassify things on purpose and they stamp things that are classified. So he's like, I don't even know what's classified and what's not classified. And that's all I remember him saying about that.
So it's even like internally, they're trying to sort of
There's ladders and
that's interesting.
A chain of command. So he did that for a while and he lived in DC and then he moved to Colorado and then he started doing some sort of like penny stock things. And then, and then he moved to Florida. But yeah, so
Florida was like kind of just a retirement spot.
Yeah. It's a place to just kind of chill. But yeah, because he had already retired at a really early age because he put so much time in the Air Force.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, the government paycheck's not bad, man.
Yeah, so he was always trying to convince me to do that. He's like, Henry, you need to go work for the government. They're going to take care of you for your life.
Yeah.
You just put in 20 years, you're going to have a pension and your healthcare all taken care of. And that was kind of what I was told to do, I guess.
How did you feel about that at the time?
I just didn't want to ever do anything like that. But I respect the people that do. I had growing up in Florida, then I had lived that kind of, for lack of a better word, the kind of the redneck life.
Sure.
I was running around fishing and hunting and doing stuff like that, surfing, just any kind of ocean related activities, like whatever you'd picture people in Florida doing, that's what I was doing. Riding four wheelers, mudding,
you literally
mudding in your truck.
Were a Florida man.
I was the Florida man. And it's so weird because like I feel like I can't relate to a lot of people now in our line of work that have ever done or experienced that kind of thing. So I have this like weird like double-sided thing to me where I just understand that life and then I understand this life too. And it's just weird balance.
Well, and it seems like I remember even the first time we were really talking back in Orange County there, like I came away with this impression that you need that in your life. Like you need to be close to the water.
I have to, man. It's just, I don't know. It's just my end all be all kind of.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah. So if you were a kid and you're out on the water all the time and just running around, did you end up, like, did you think you were going to kind of have that lifestyle forever? Like wanted to stay close to that?
Yeah. So the kind of the job to do out of a lot of my friends still do it is they work in the fishing industry. Some of them are reps for fishing companies, but a lot of them, they run charter boats. Mm. So they partner up with someone who has a yacht and then they run like these fishing charter businesses. And I was like, really wanted to do that. I was like, I want to have a fishing charter business. And then some people do commercial fishing, but commercial fishing is like, that's the toughest job in the world.
Yeah, I can imagine.
If you think like not being able to get a DJ gig is tough, imagine going out in the middle of the ocean and just the fish aren't fucking biting today.
Sure, of course. Yeah. And it's super competitive and some of it can be, this is not at all the same thing, but I had a friend from high school who went and did like Alaskan crab fishing.
Oh, wow.
And that is...
That's a real deal.
I mean, yeah, he was saying he saw guys, you know, lose limbs and, you know, sometimes they wouldn't find anything and you'd be freezing.
The ocean up there too. The water's way colder up there. The ocean's rougher. Like it's...
Yeah, it sounded really intense.
I actually did commercial fishing for a little bit briefly in high school.
Oh, really?
Met this boat captain. He needed some help. And then me and my buddies were like, he's like, I'll take you guys out and, you know, give you $50 for coming on the boat. So we did that for a little bit. So that was kind of my first job, I guess.
Did you like it?
Oh, yeah, dude. I was like, the hours were a little long. Like we would go out at like 10 p.m. at night.
Yeah.
We'd catch shitfish all night. Shitfish is any miscellaneous fish you get like 25 cents a pound for at the market. And we would catch these like shitfish all night, like shit for six fish. Hours. And then the sun comes up. And then right at when the sun comes up, that's like the best time to ever go fishing.
Okay.
Is sunrise or sunset. Cause that's when the fish start feeding. It's like, you know, you wake up in the morning, you eat breakfast.
Yeah.
And just you eat
naturally.
Eat dinner at night. And the fish are kind of on the same schedule.
Sure.
In the middle of the day, they're kind of sleeping. Yeah. We would just catch these shitfish all night and then wait till the sun would start coming up. And then we go target like the bigger game fish. And catch those. And the bigger game fish, you know, you can get a couple dollars a pound for the good ones.
Okay.
And then we just load the boat up with all these fish.
What's like the rarest, you know, most desirable fish that you would want to catch?
For the market?
Yeah. Like in the area at the time. Like what was like the legendary fish?
There's these fish called cobia. They're not really legendary, but they're the tastiest and they're just the most fun to catch because you see them and they're like, they'll be swimming on stingrays. So you sight fish cobia. So you got to sit there and you got to look for hours and hours and hours. You sit there in the tower and then you see a stingray and you're like, ray. You ease the boat over, you see the stingray and they swim behind the stingray. Cause what they do is the stingray flaps its wings and stirs up all the crabs off the bottom. And the cobia sit behind the stingray and they just pick off the crabs that the stingray flaps up. And then you throw your jig in the water and then you catch them from sight fishing.
Wow.
So that's kind of like where I lived. That was kind of like the species to catch.
Sure.
And they net a lot of money at the markets as well. And they're absolutely delicious.
Man.
Best tasting fish in the ocean.
Wow. That's nuts, man. Yeah. I love hearing the like little niche.
Yeah. Like I could talk for hours about that little details of the stingray flapping its wings. It's just, man, it's a whole nother world out there.
Yeah, of course, man. Do you still living here? Are you able to get out on the water a lot? I mean, obviously you're on the road.
Then I kind of switched from fishing to surfing to kind of fill that void, I guess, when I went to college. So I went to college in Orlando at UCF and I just brought my surfboard with me because I didn't have a boat anymore. I was an hour away from the ocean in Orlando because Orlando's landlocked in the middle. So when we had time, me and my buddies would just drive to like the beaches and like New Smyrna Beach and just go surfing.
Right.
So then I picked up surfing.
Yeah. And that's become like a huge thing for you.
Yeah. And then that's become like, you know, one of my favorite things to do. And then here, I mean, I'm about 25 minutes from the beach. So
okay.
I go every week.
Yeah. That's
I'll wake up on Monday morning at 7 a.m. I'll go surf for 2 hours, come back and work on music the rest of the day. And it just kind of keeps that balance. And
there's not a lot of surfing DJs, I feel like. It's I know What's So Not is all about.
Yeah. Well, I actually saw him one day at Malibu. He's a gnarly boogie boarder.
Mm.
He does, I don't know if you know Jinko, the trap DJ.
Yeah, I do.
He's a really good surfer.
Okay.
Cutsnake. Fisher.
Fisher
for
is
those of you
surfer?
Guys listening, Fisher used to be a pro surfer.
Ooh, baby.
He's insane. So how do I say it? Like, you know how he's like really like a funny guy?
Yeah.
Like he's hilarious. That was his personality in the surfing world too. So in surfing world, he was kind of the class clown of surfing.
Right.
And he's a pro surfer, but he was also like an announcer.
That makes a lot
of
sense.
So he was like commentating these events and he was just always cracking everyone up.
That makes a lot of
sense. So I remember watching pro surfing and he was commenting on the events and then he started DJing with Cutsnake and I met both of them at a festival one time, got to know him a little bit and then all of a sudden he's Fisher and I'm just like...
Come on, man. Yeah. What a life.
He's
That's
just
insane.
Like a...
I really want to get him on this show.
Oh, man.
I feel like he'd be such an entertaining...
He's always been like that, even back to the surfing days. Like, he was always like a jokester.
Which is
like
the
funny
best.
Guy.
Yeah, those are my favorite kind of people, man.
That's his true self, you know? Right. He's not putting on some crazy act. Like,
and I think that's why it works for him. I think for anybody, like, I had Carnage on the show, and I talked to some people who knew him, like, way before he was a big-time DJ, and they were just like, oh, yeah, he's been
he's
like
always
that.
Like that. Yeah.
Which I respect that, man. Anyone who doesn't let the business change them has just kind of always been however they are. That's the hardest thing to do, man.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like, this is just a random aside, but do you feel like you had to change and adapt anything that didn't naturally fit with your personality to sort of operate effectively in the music industry?
A little bit, yeah. It's just the time away from like just like the super, super long hours at a computer and learning how to produce. I love DJing. I've been DJing, you know, 10 years now.
Yeah.
DJing doesn't bother me. Actually, traveling doesn't bother me at all. I feel like I could play 7 shows in a row, just travel, play, and I'd be cool. Like touring, when I'm touring, I'm not especially heavily touring. Like, you know, I've been touring now for 7 years and
yeah.
I don't really get too exhausted or I don't get too burnt out on it.
I feel the same as you, man. I mean, there's certainly days when I'm pretty bummed out about being at the airport at 5 in the morning. But overall, the whole package, I actually really, really like it. And I do get exhausted, but it doesn't necessarily bother me too much.
Yeah, I just need that laid back kind of nature-inspired lifestyle too, because that's just what I came from and that's just what I'm used to and that keeps me sane. So when I'm here and I come back from tour, the first thing I do is I come on Monday and I go out for a surf.
Mm. Just kind of reset.
Yeah, relax. And just, you know, it's just so important to, I don't know, I just feel like it's almost like primitive that's where humans are supposed to be anyways.
Mm.
That's what we're kind of, I think, like wired for.
Yeah.
So, you know, you hear a lot of DJs talking about it. They're like, you know, sometimes it's good to just get out and go on hikes and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's true.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way, man. I'm not as good about getting out in nature as I should be, but it is like I go to the gym all the time.
That's
like
good too.
You know, I have a thing that's like
that's
that.
Good.
It's yeah. I wish it was more nature based, but it works. And it's really important. I think, yeah, those little rituals, those routines, when you know that it'll reset you.
100%.
No matter how weird you feel at the time, by the time it's done, you know?
So I think a lot of these like new producers that blow up really, really fast, they just like whatever their old routines were and what kind of kept them who they were, it kind of goes out the window. And then all of a sudden they're just flying around, playing shows, partying, drinking, drugs, blah, 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 in the studio for 8 hours straight. Not, you know, sitting down and then... boom, it just really catches up with them sometimes and stuff. So
absolutely.
If anyone listening, you know, just you really got to just break up that time with.
Yeah. And it's tough because it's so hard to understand when you're young that it is going to be that way. But if you can establish any kind of, even if it's just like an old friend that you call every once in a while, you know, something simple like that, but just maintaining those connections to the old life, like where you came from.
Dude, I think you just can't forget it.
Yeah, man. So crucial.
So back to your question. Sorry, we got in a big
No, that's good.
It was like, yeah, I kind of had to... I always wanted to figure out a way to just incorporate that kind of ocean lifestyle with my brand. So I do post surfing photos every once in a while, you know, stuff like that. It's very like, my brand's very laid back. It's very, it is truly who I am. So I've kind of battled because for a little bit, I feel like I was dressing like a DJ.
Yeah.
You moved to LA and you just...
Dude, I was
joggers
just,
and your Adidas shoes and your long baggy black shirt with the wide neck. And you're just like, I went through a phase where I was like wearing that shit like a year straight. And then I was like, now look at me. I'm like, dude, that's not, you know.
Yeah, you look like a surfer.
Yeah, like that's not who I am.
Right.
Yeah, dude,
I was
that?
Just talking to someone about that. It's so funny. Because, I think, you know, everyone wants to look good in the promo pictures. And everybody else looks cool.
She's so like, no one's going to care if I don't look the...
Right.
Like. So I did that for a year and I was like, now I'm kind of back to just my true self, I think.
And that's what it's all about. I think in 2019, that's where everything is heading to. Because
absolutely. I think, I see a big trend.
Yeah, man. Because it's less about being part of a scene or a movement now. And it's really about like, just authenticity and kind of...
People can see through it too, you know? Everyone looking at your stuff. I feel like
the
real fans can tell who's authentic and who's not.
I agree. Now. And I think it's also about... sort of just having your own movement, you know, and that it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to fit in necessarily with whatever the hot trend is.
Yeah, but remember like in 2013, that was different. Everyone was trying to fit this EDM mold or whatever it was. And it's like, imagine if you're an outsider. I'm just like, hey, I'm just a surfer. I'm going to wear flip-flops and just go chill. It's like, at that time it was kind of not.
Yeah, so that was something you had to change or felt like you had to change a little bit.
I didn't change too much of it. I always still left that in there.
Right.
But I think right now as an artist, it's couldn't be a more better time. More better.
Way more louder.
More louder.
Yes.
It couldn't be a better time to kind of just pursue what you want to pursue and be your own person and artist. And I think right now it's cool. It's kind of cool because it's... I just feel like it's kind of wide open, man.
I think so too. And conversely, I think there's never been a worse time to chase the trends.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Because I still see a million people doing it and no one is getting away with it anymore.
It's funny. There's almost two business models as a producer and DJ.
Yeah.
You know, you can be that guy that's so off the rocker, really doing your own thing, or you can keep up with the trends. And both of them work,
right,
to be honest. Like I've seen, you know, some of the guys from my big room world do that and keep up with the trends and it works for them.
Sure.
And then you see guys like who's someone that's just like Mr. Carmack or something.
Right.
He just really fucking does his own thing. And that works too.
Absolutely, like, man. Absolutely. And you're right that there's no one right way to do it. I mean, anyone listening to us, like you don't even listen to us.
There's literally no right way to do it.
But I think we've been doing this long enough that you are able to start seeing the cycles and the waves.
Yes.
And
isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Now that, like we've seen the cycle come around, you know, at least twice.
Right.
And everything just recycles itself with a new rebirth. Like I remember when I first started hearing the Jaws sound, I guess, come up, like the bass house sound.
I know
like,
where you're going with this.
I was like, bro, jack beats, but it's on steroids.
Right.
Or like because we kind of, I guess, listened to the same stuff back then, you know,
a lot of like baseline, the UK stuff,
a lot of like Crookers and stuff like that, that electro house, like kind of blog house kind of stuff. And I remember hearing that and I was like, dude, that's so cool that Jaws brought that back, but he just, the synths are on steroids now and like,
yeah,
making it with serum sounds and stuff. And it just sounded fucking so heavy and big, but it was still that, had that, kind of 2010 electro vibe to it.
Right, right. Well, really this cool. is before I hit record, we were talking about Wolfgang Gardner
and some
of the stuff he said when he was on this show. One thing you mentioned is, you know, how he was saying you don't have to invent everything. You can take, you know, a cool idea or a popular sound, and if you're able to just sort of put your own twist on it, just change, I say this all the time, just change one little thing. Sometimes that's all it takes.
It can literally be like a sound as small as like a snare, like what Jackie did with the Jackie snare. They use some flam weird thing and they click, and then all of a sudden, boom, everyone's, you know, and it just identifies their sound. It's just one little thing like that.
Yeah.
But you're right. These guys that are really kind of caught big waves the last couple of years, they kind of were taking old dance sounds and just kind of putting their own twist on it and taking it to a new place.
Yeah, and it does make me happy too that some of the, I don't know what you want to call it, retro sounds or more 90s influence sounds are kind of coming back now.
Absolutely.
Too. Because that's what I grew up just loving, man. It's all the old rave stabs.
I love that stuff too, man.
Oh, man. So what was the scene like in Orlando when you started DJing out in college? How'd you even start DJing?
You know, Kilogram and Nims from Milo Notice.
That's right.
So, I met Nims through a couple buddies and we became friends and hung out in the same crew. And one night he just had his like DJ shit set up. I was like, yo, can you show me how to do that? He's like, yeah, show me how to DJ. And then me and him put together a night and we were like, hey, let's make the first EDM night at the college. But this wasn't even called EDM. We just called it electro.
Sure.
This was 2009. So we were pretty early to the scene, I think, a little bit. So,
well, how did you even get in, before we get to the DJing, how did you get into the music at all?
Okay, so
Was it big out there?
So, yes. So, there was one night. So, Orlando, out of all of the US, I feel like Orlando was kind of a tastemaker market. Orlando was a little bit ahead of the curve. You know, you obviously had, you know, LA and New York and other places like that that were pretty far ahead too. But I think in the South, Orlando was really ahead of the curve with that stuff. And I remember one of my, I lived in a fraternity house for 3 years.
Nice.
And one of the guys in my house, he was bartending at this bar that used to have these like electro nights. And this was in 2009, 2008. And one night, this was early Steve Aoki. He's like, dude, we had this DJ named Steve Aoki there. When Steve Aoki was playing that like indie electro sound,
sure,
which was fucking dope. Remember the early Dimmock stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, dude, my favorite.
Crazy.
And he's like, hey, I recorded the CD like from Steve Aoki. And he would get the recordings from the sound guy and bring them home. And I'd put them on my laptop and I was listening to all these mixes. So two of the guys in my fraternity that were kind of like the, I guess, emo scene kids in the fraternity
right.
were giving me these CDs from this club. And then I was playing them. I'm like, yo, this shit is awesome. And then then my sister too kind of influenced me. My sister was like really into Daft Punk. She found Justice.
Mm.
So my sister was like way more musically advanced than me.
Right.
So she showed me like Justice and stuff. And yeah, then that's how I just got into it. And I started listening to more and more electronic music. And then I got so deep into it. I was like, and then I started seeing the local DJs.
Yeah.
And there's this DJ named Polly Crush. He threw this Monday night and it was just straight blog house.
Yeah.
Before it was even called blog house.
Right.
We used to call it indie electro.
Sure.
If you know that just 2008 to 2010,
indie dance,
whatever you want to call it, like, man. And I remember a couple of my buddies took me to that night and I was watching just the vibe in there, dude. It was so like, I didn't know any of the songs anyone was playing. Everyone was just dancing at that night. At that point in time, there was no like jumping up and down on the dance floor. It was just, you look around and everybody's just grooving and dancing.
Yep.
And it was kind of a little more of a hipster crowd too, a little more hipster movement.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Which the hipster movement, I don't even know if that exists now in the way that it
I don't think it exists
then.
In dance music anymore.
Right. Like, if it does, I mean, it's very underground at this point.
I wonder what they would listen to right now.
I mean,
if you were like really hipster.
To be honest, I think I know. I mean, it still exists. Like, you look at, you know, like some of the Boiler Room stuff, some of like Resident Advisor stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, I think it's gone a bit more global. Like, there's DJs all around the world kind of making their own sounds from their own cultures, but updating it with electronics and dance influences and all that. And I mean, I've been to some hipster bars in Brooklyn in the last...
I think you nailed it with Boiler Room, because you picture just the people that are like sitting behind a DJ in Boiler Room.
Right.
It's like, that's it.
yeah, for sure. And I'm not even hating on that. It's just, I don't know, maybe in another 5-10 years, what's going on there will become the mainstream, you know?
Because I think at the time
possible.
The hipsters were listening to that stuff like La Rue and like all that stuff. And all those remixes, do you remember all those remixes from the Blockhouse
era?
Of course,
like, yeah.
And so they got kind of strung into, they were following those indie bands, and then they got strung into the electro remixes, and that's how it became like, so.
I mean, just one last thought I had on that is I think back then being a hipster in the music world meant that you listened to everything and you liked everything, you know what I mean? But now, I mean, that's what every kid does, right?
Yeah.
Like now that's...
It's like normal.
Yeah, it's super normal.
It's normal to find underground music.
Yeah, and people don't care about genres at this point.
Yeah, it's good.
You know, back then, not caring about genres was like kind of rare, you know? Most people would sort of stick to their one...
Especially at that time with... styles of music outside of that, like imagine, like I have one of my roommates was like, listen, he was like a hardcore kid. He's like, only listen to hardcore,
right?
And I hear the shit he says about certain bands, and he's like very picky about the hardcore bands he would listen to, and if they, you know, if they didn't play one song off their out, oh man,
yeah. So I mean, the hipster thing, it was almost, you know, you being ballsy to say, oh no, I like this pop music and I like this weird dance music and I like this rap song,
because it was all combined into this weird.
Yeah, like that was like kind of revolutionary at the time. And I don't know, man. So yeah, maybe the next wave of hipsters is actually finding the music you can't find, which is hard to do because most music is so easily available.
Back then, do you remember like the way you would find that music is you would go to these blogs like Vacay Vitamins or whatever.
Gotta Dance Dirty. All of those.
And you would just download, remember they would post it and you just download the MP3 straight off the fucking
site. Straight off the website, man.
Like it was so, man, it was just so like, not exclusive, it was just so like you had to know where to go.
That was the thing. And once you got there, it was like a secret club. Because once you found the website, once you knew where to go, then it was just
then
free.
Your library was just filling up every. You're checking back in the websites every day.
Every day, because they'd post
download.
And they were the only places to get it.
Yeah.
But once you got there, there was no, you know, no download gate. It wasn't about that. It was just this sort of secret club.
Sharing the music.
Yeah.
And then, so I remember the DJs were playing. There was one night in Orlando called Crush. They was playing that on Monday nights. And then there was another night called Takeover on Tuesdays that was playing that. And I was like, you know what? I love this music too. I was like, no one started a night at the college. So I was pretty networked with my college. I was really active on campus. I played intramural sports. I was in the fraternity. I was like social.
The emo fraternity.
My fraternity was like that no identity.
Yeah.
There was rednecks and surfers and emos and athletes. It was a little bit of everyone. Yeah. And then it worked together. And anyway, so I was really active on campus. So I knew a lot of kids at the school. So then me and my buddy and Nims, we went to and this other guy, Nick, we kind of went to the bar and we're just like, hey, we want to start a dance music night. Dance music's, you know, this electro sound's getting really popular. Can we do a night? Said, yeah, let's do it. So we cut out a deal and they gave us the side. The most popular college bar in Orlando called Knight's Library. I don't know if you've ever been to Orlando.
I have been to Orlando.
By UCF, there was this bar called Knight's Library, which is absolutely legendary place.
Is it still there?
It's still there, but it moved locations.
Ah, okay.
And so they gave us the side room there and we started this night in the side room called Riot Wednesdays.
Right.
And it took a little while to get the month going. And I remember, I basically was head of all the marketing and promoting. So I had to figure that out from the ground up.
How did that go?
I just remember just flyering, putting flyers on the windshields.
Yeah.
I'd put flyers in the student housing mailboxes. I would convince the people to open them up for me and put all the flyers in there. I remember Facebook had just launched their ad campaign, so I learned how to use Facebook ads really early on, which was it was unbeatable at the time because you could actually reach people with it.
Yeah, exactly.
And that would actually come. I remember people would tell me, I'm like, how'd you find out about the night? They're like, oh, we saw the Facebook ad. I was like, fuck.
Yeah, man. I miss those days. I mean, even Facebook events back in the day. That was such
Facebook
a good way.
Yeah, Facebook events
were fire. Yeah, it was so good.
And then, so I did. And then I hired a team of street promoters, worked with them, you know, let them sell tickets and stuff and hired different bartenders. And then sure enough, man, it became the kind of a thing. It went from 20 people the first couple of weeks, 50 people. And then the next thing I know, man, we had our work cut out for us. And this shit was line of fucking wrapped around the block. Mm. No name local DJs every single Wednesday night, like clockwork, man. People were driving from 2 hours away to go to this night because it was notoriously sweaty and crazy.
And probably you were early to that sound, right? So probably,
oh, dude, like, we were taste making music in the city. There was a handful of guys, like those guys from the Tuesday night. There's a handful of DJs there. And then the guys from Monday night, they were really ahead of the curve. And we just kind of took that formula and we just kind of put it to the college kids. And I remember at the time, Dimmack had their Tuesday night here, which was a pretty legendary night that Steve Aoki was running too. And all of it was kind of modeled after each other. You know, the guys in Florida had modeled it off of the LA scene a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And regionally, like there were a bunch of cities that had, you know, that one.
Did you guys have one in Chicago?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, Flostradamus was the original. They had their parties called Get Out of the Hood, which was this weekly. They did it at a dive bar that held like 70 people.
So epic,
in,
man.
In like a part of town you would never go to. It was, and yeah, those parties were
New
amazing.
York had one.
Yeah.
San Francisco had a kind of hipster electro party. Georgia, they had one in Atlanta.
Yeah.
So they started kind of popping up and it was just this movement of that bloghouse stuff. And then, yeah, we started this night, man. And it was just, man, for about 2 years, it was basically packed to capacity every week. So me and Nims were the DJs. And then I found this guy, Kilogram, who him and Nims later became Milo Notice, making the trap stuff.
Yep.
And I remember he came up to me one night and he was just like, hey, do you have dubstep? I was like, fuck yeah. And I played like Flux Pavilion, Goldust or something.
That's
and then
awesome.
That's how I met Kilogram. And then we brought him on the night and he would play dubstep the last 30 minutes of the night. And then all of a sudden dubstep got really popular. And then people were coming to the night to hear dubstep.
Right.
Now. And then I remember like Swedish House Mafia and Avicii sound getting popular. And we started playing that sound, and then that's when I saw the shift of the hipster electro crowd move, bloghouse started to die, and then it became this big room, like,
yeah,
the progressive sound
changed,
and then the culture totally flipped and the crowd, I saw the crowds get bigger.
Yeah,
that's what made the night big, honestly. Dance music just was
sure you were there
the right
for
time.
The
yeah.
explosion of it, which is really interesting. And I mean, I feel like even when you as a producer blew up, that was the same thing, right? Like you were on that wave of EDM, like you were actual EDM.
Like, yeah, I was like as big room.
Because I, you know, especially on this show, like EDM gets thrown around to mean a million different things, but you literally, like, that was you.
Yeah, it's like that 2010 to 2014 sound, whatever that was, whatever you want to call it. It's like, yeah. So I feel like, I don't know, man, that was a crazy weird time. And again, I just, it was such a blur and it happened so fast that I didn't have time to really, I was just running my night, man. I was like, we were keeping up with the cutting edge of dance music and we were playing it. It didn't matter what genre it was. We were just like, yo, we're going to play whatever is going to get this party fucking hype, you know? And so
who else was around? Weren't there a few other DJs in Orlando who ended up being
Mo Green?
Right. That's
so
right.
So we found Mo Green from that night too.
Oh, okay.
He saw the Facebook ads and came into the party. So the whole crew is like me, Milo Notice, Mo Green, and then Dallas K too. We found Dallas K.
Oh, Dallas K. I forgot.
He's from Orlando. Yeah. And then we brought him on the night too. And he DJed with us too. And he was kind of just like the prodigy, man. So then I learned to produce from those guys because I was more of the, like the face promoter guy.
Yeah.
Then DJ. Yeah. And then a couple of times they were all three of them were just like, hey, you want to learn how to make music? And I would just watch them make beats and stuff. And then I downloaded Ableton and boom, I started making beats.
I mean, between all of those people, man.
Man, I must have
learned a lot.
Bro, I'm so lucky. I honestly couldn't have had better teachers. And, you know, I got to give those guys props because I feel like I wouldn't be sitting here today if I never learned how to make music from those guys.
Yeah. So how long from when you started making music, started producing, that is, until you actually, you know, made something that people would want to DJ, something that might get signed? Was it a pretty quick process?
Yeah, it was really quick, man. It was about a year.
Yeah.
I put a year into it, and I probably made music 8 hours a day, every single day.
Yeah.
And then, you know, watching my buddies make beats, I learned so quick. You know, downloaded Silanth, learned how to process the shit on Silanth, learned how to distort the basses. And I started making electro first.
Yeah.
Because that was kind of the sound. And I remember I put out this Mike Snow bootleg. I made some Mike Snow electro remix. And I put it in and went number one on Hype Machine. I was like, oh shit.
That meant a lot.
And then after it went
to
number one. Yeah. You remember how credible that was?
Yeah.
That was like a number one.
No, people would start whole careers off of that. Like labels.
There was a lot of artists that were blowing up and touring acts off of Hype Machine.
Right. Because I remember even labels were like searching Hype Machine, you know?
And then the dubstep and stuff was on there and everyone started making those dubstep remixes. And so, yeah, I did that. And then that was kind of my foot in the door. And then I started uploading stuff to SoundCloud. And then that's how it started. And then from there, I went to getting a couple DJs. I remember the first DJ to play one of my songs was Chucky.
Oh, okay.
Chucky put one of my things in his podcast, and then I think Tiesto played one, and I was like, oh fuck. I was like, this is all I wanted, man. Right. I thought that was the peak.
That was it.
Yeah, I was like, that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to sit here and DJ my night and then have some big DJs play my shit. And I was like, all right, cool.
Did you have plans post college? Like,
no. So they all got derailed, man, because I started doing this right towards the end of college, middle to end of college. And then by the time I graduated, I still stayed on track. I graduated, although I did take the easiest classes I could take because I already knew. I was like, oh, I'm just going to keep DJing.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, so let me just take these easy classes. Yeah. But that was by like junior year.
Yeah.
I managed to graduate. And then right after graduation, told my parents, I was like, I'm just staying in Orlando for a little bit. This DJ thing, you know, I'm DJing 3 or 4 nights a week.
Yeah.
My parents are kind of like, oh, it's an excuse. You just want to party because you had so much fun in Orlando.
Right.
And I was like, no, like, let me just do this. And then we went through this phase where we didn't really talk about it anymore because they were pretty disappointed in me.
Yeah.
Because I wanted them to go off and do something else,
of
you know?
Of course.
And I just stuck with it, man. I was like, look, I can make a living. I was making a living DJing 4 nights a week.
Yeah. I mean, just as a local
DJ,
resident,
that's a good living, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially in a cheap college town.
That's what I was about to say, man. If you can become the guy in whatever town you're in, that's not a bad life, man.
Dude, absolutely. So my nightlife company and all that stuff, the events were doing well. And then I started getting booked out slowly, like playing once in Miami, play once in Tallahassee or Gainesville.
Just because
Dude that has the night.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we want to book him, you know?
Yeah.
And people in Florida knew what Riot was and stuff. And then it started from there. And then
what was the first big tune you put out that really got you attention on a national level? Was it the Hype Machine one?
Nobody knew who I was, though.
Right.
So that was just like, oh, here's a cool remix. And there's this guy's name on it. And that was just like, okay, one thing. And I remember getting like 10,000 plays on SoundCloud. And I was like, fuck yeah.
You're right.
Back then, it might have been less. It might have been 3,000. But then, that was a fuckload, you know?
Oh, yeah, man. And you see the little comment bar fill up, all of that.
Yeah. Me and my buddy Landis made this song and we sent it into Hardwell's label, and then Hardwell put it on a compilation or something.
Yeah.
In 2012 or 13, I don't remember. And that was the first one. I was like, oh, signed to Revealed. And Revealed at that time, they were so ahead of the curve with the big room tunes, and they were literally one of the hottest labels. So it was that. And then me and Mac J made this song called Encore.
Right.
And that was like a pretty popular big room song. And it was just a string, man. I had like 3, 4, 5 big room songs through 2013. And it was just when big room was at just like blowing up.
Yeah. I remember, I think I was aware of what you were doing, but I think when I really, really locked in was when you had the Ausla release.
Yeah.
With Stand Up.
Okay. Yeah. So Stand Up, I was a free release in 2013 or 14.
Okay.
I put it up for free download. All these DJs started playing it. That was actually the one because it was a solo song too. And I just remember Knife Party playing it, like random people playing it, like maybe like Kill the Noise or.
Yeah.
And then I remember.
It had that crossover appeal in a weird way.
It was like big room, but I didn't want to make that like cheesy kind of big room sound.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But with the chords.
Yeah. It was like less commercial big room.
Yeah. So I was trying to kind of keep it more like club. And then I remember doing that, and then Yeah, Ausla signed it because I knew Blaze from Ausla. He actually was a DJ in Gainesville at the time.
That's right.
So yeah. I knew him through a couple other buddies, and then we linked up and we played a couple shows together in Florida. And then he was like, "Hey man, if you have any..." He hit me up. He's like, "Hey man, I saw that sound, that stand-up song you put on your SoundCloud. Like, do you want to release that?" I was like, "Fuck yeah, I want to release it."
Yeah.
So then they put it with these remixes. They got the Destructor remix, then they got the Milo Notice remix, and then Dallas did a remix, and then Ausla put that out, and that was
yeah.
Big release for me.
And yeah, because I think Ausla, of course, was a hipster label at the time. That was like such a, you know, quote unquote cool label.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think people beyond Big Room maybe started noticing what you were doing at that point.
So I was aware of like kind of what the different worlds were. I was like, there's this like American dance world with these artists, and then there's this European dance world with these certain labels. So I was like releasing on these American labels, but then I was releasing on these like Dutch labels too. So I was releasing on like Spinnin',
right,
releasing on like Musical Freedom and Revealed, but then I was releasing on Ausla and stuff like that and Dimmak and stuff.
Yeah.
So I kind of was like just treading this weird line of like, what was cool in America and what was like cool overseas.
Was there ever a thought to try to find a home? You know what I mean? To sign up with a label for a long-term thing?
A little bit. Yeah, I had some offers for like, you know, some like full deals and stuff, but I liked the ability to just be like, hey, I want to finish a song and just, I want to release it wherever I want to release it.
One, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but to me, that seems like you would have a broader appeal globally too, right?
Yeah.
Because as far as I know, you've always done really well overseas, and probably even to this day, right? You can go and play shows in places that some other people can't.
Yeah, and I definitely think that's because of those releases for like from like on like Spinnin' and stuff. Like I was able to play. I tour in Asia heavily.
Yeah.
Still, and I've always kind of toured in Asia pretty heavily, and it's definitely from those overseas releases on those, you know, international labels, and that definitely helped a lot. But it was weird because I was just treading this line of like it was weird, man. Like Kill the Noise and Knife Party and Skrillex would be playing my stuff, but then like Hardwell and Tiesto was like playing my stuff, and like even like Armin van Buuren or something.
Right.
And it's just like I was just like, hey, I just want to be that dude. You know, I just want to be friends with everybody.
Yeah.
So over the years, I just ended up making friends with guys from Bass World, guys from Trap World, but then guys from Big Room World. And it was just like, I don't know, it was weird. But then I feel like things started to change a lot, and that strategy wasn't working anymore by around 2016.
Yeah, trying to be the guy who does everything got harder.
Yeah, because everyone kind of sectioned off into their little bubbles and stuff, and it became really clicky, and labels were really interested in building artists from the ground up. And my plan of like, hey, I'm just going to just finish a song and wherever the song fits, I'm going to do it and just get these fans all over the place. Because I saw, I was talking actually with Showtech the other day, and they told me that too.
Mm.
They were like, when they got started on their like Big Room rebrand, they released an EP with Dimmak. They released an EP with Ausla. They did records on Spinnin'. They did the same thing.
Right.
And their goal was to kind of hit a variety of audiences.
Yeah, it's interesting, man. And it's a funny full circle moment too, because you just put something out with them, right?
Yeah.
That Rave Tool tune, which I feel like it has been a big tune for you.
A bunch
of DJs from a bunch of different worlds are playing it.
So that is kind of like my old plan, but like, I guess realized again, like I was always like, I never really... You know, I was kind of known for certain sounds. I was known for like, you know, maybe using some reggae dancehall sounds, but then also some Big Room sounds. But then I was known for a couple different things, and I never really had my foot in the door on one thing. But what I did know is like, I just really enjoyed making music that was playing at the festival. So when I made Rave Tool, that was me sitting down, be like, all right, what is a fucking banger in 2019? I'm just going to make the craziest thing I can make and just see what happens. So I sat down one day and I was like, I'm just going to make the most obnoxiously ignorant thing I can make.
Yeah.
And there we go.
Yeah. And it turns out that's what people want.
And then people started playing and I was like, oh man, do I got to make that every time if I want DJs playing my shit? Yeah.
But it's cool, but in a way it must feel good to have that happen in today's climate and to realize that, hey, you can break back in whenever you want, right?
Yeah, it is. You can really make whatever the hell you want as long as the song's good. People are gonna, you know what I mean?
If
they DJs start playing a song if it works, you know, and they like to play it. And then it's this weird chain reaction. And I was really after that again, you know,
sure.
Like it was 2013. I was like, dude, I want to have my shit playing on the festivals again. Cause I went through this phase where I was like really making a lot of like global based stuff, which I kind of started making more of the global based stuff, I think in 2015 and end of 2014. Do you remember like, obviously like Moonbatoon and Twerk had a big movement in 2011 and I was around for that. And I didn't really give it enough attention as I should have because I was so caught up in like Dutch House and Big Room and stuff. So then that I was aware of the artists. I was aware of, you know, Munchie and all these guys making all this dope Moonbatoon stuff and guys making all the trap stuff.
Right.
And I liked it. And then, but I was so consumed in this world. And then things flipped and I kind of went backwards in time.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, I missed this era of Moonbatoon. Let's see.
Yeah. And I want to talk about that period for a little bit because we mentioned how you blew up out of the gate so fast and things turned into a whirlwind, right? And how, you know, after a year or two of that craziness of touring around, just putting out songs to feed the beast, you know, did you start to notice, like you said that, you know, things got more sectioned off and the scene was changing. And did you start to feel like you didn't know how to change with it, or more that, you know, you just kind of wanted to take stock and kind of figure out why this was exciting to you again?
Yeah, because it's weird. You get thrown into it for a certain sound. Like I got thrown into it with the Big Room sound and I was like, you know what? This is just like, I just don't want to make this forever. And I was like, the industry's changing, number one. Number two, I don't want to make this sound anymore. I was just over it.
Right.
So then I was starting to look to all the other genres that I had missed and gone back.
Right.
And I wanted to also, I had a goal of trying to be the most diverse producer I could. So I was like, I wanted to kind of backstep and be like, hang on a second. Let me see what else is out there and let me see what other inspirations I can draw from everything. So that was at the end of about 2014. And then my old manager, I made this like Big Room song, but it had all these like reggae and dancehall sounds. It was called Wind Him. And all these DJs started playing it.
Yeah, I remember that song.
Oh, you remember it?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I was definitely playing that.
That's dope to hear. Do you remember that one?
Yeah. No, now that you mentioned, I played the shit out of that song.
Like Calvin Harris was playing and all these DJs were playing. My manager's like, you need to make more stuff like that, that has that, you know, just that global vibe to it. And then I was like, okay, that's probably a good idea. And I have a pretty big knowledge of reggae and dancehall because I used to listen to so much reggae and dancehall growing up in South Florida.
That was just around a lot.
Oh, dude, you turn on the radio and it's like, do you remember like peak Sean Paul in like 2000s?
Yeah.
Like, I was living through like peak dancehall on American radio.
Right.
Like Elephant Man was having like features on all the hip hop songs.
Yep.
Sean Paul was at his peak. Oh, man, that was a cool era. And then reggaeton was huge. Like Daddy Yankee was like blowing up.
Of course. One, especially in Florida with all the Latino people.
Yeah. Exactly. So South Florida is very ethnically diverse. So we'd pick up all the radio stations from Miami where I lived and that kind of filtered in too. Mm. But yeah, my manager kind of was like, at the time, he was just kind of like wanted me to take a more global approach to my music,
right,
which was smart because I was like, okay, I was like, you know, I know all the artists, I know a lot of the sound. So I kind of took a re-step back and figured that out. And then in 2015, I think I put out the song called Drop It Down Low, which is just like 100 BPM dancehall song. And it ended up kind of, this gamer made it go like viral. That was really weird.
A gamer?
A gamer made it go viral.
Like what, he just put it in a gamer video?
Yeah, he put it in a game, but then it became his like announcement, like his intro song for every vlog on YouTube.
And he was a popular gamer.
And he was a really popular gamer. I don't even know what game he played. His name's Bai Tarifa. He's some Spanish guy.
Okay. Did you have to have a conversation about money and all that?
I didn't care, man, because he was driving all these streams from people all over the world to the song. And then, that's when I hit my production breakthrough on like the 100 BPM stuff. It was like 2015.
Yeah.
And at that time, Moonbatoon was, for lack of a better word, it was pretty dead still. There was a lot of guys that have been making it for a long time. And shout out to those guys that have upheld that culture and really, really, really have been passionate about that. And so I kind of just, I made 100 BPM song and I was like, oh, this is fun, man. This is a new groove.
Right.
I can take all these sounds I made in Big Room and I can kind of put them in a different way. And that was just natural for me. Like Moonbatoon is slow Big Room anyways.
Right.
Slow
Dutch House. Literally. Yeah.
It's literally that. So to slow it down to, you know, 108, I was like, oh, dude, this is fun. It's like making Big Room, but it's not Big Room.
Right.
And then I remember I had a couple other 100 BPM ones. And then I did a remix for J Balvin in 2017. and that one kind of blew up a little bit. And like J Balvin was like playing it on his tour.
Well, I was going to say you were early on J Balvin and, you know, what would become this explosion of Latin pop.
I was one of the first people to remix that song, I think.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah.
Because now you look in 2019 again, Latin pop is, you know, having a huge moment.
Absolutely. And then I did a dancehall song with Hardwell. And it was just like, that was like, you know, from 2000, I think I started making that song in like 2016.
Yeah.
And I just kind of caught a second wave with the global bass sound, I think.
Yeah. And once again, this goes back to what we were saying of, you know, this is your authentic influences, you know?
Dude, it's so easy for me to go back and like get inspiration from like all these dancehall songs that I listened to from the 90s and 2000s, especially, you know, in South Florida, it's just ingrained in you.
Right.
So,
and one thing I've always liked about your music too is that no matter what genre it is, you can tell that it's you.
That's what I hoped. Man, that's honestly, I'm glad you said that, dude. And I appreciate that because that's my main mission.
Well,
you
there's
know?
This like, I was talking to Party Favor and I said the same thing to him that I'm going to say to you is there's this like really awesome simplicity to a lot of your music.
Absolutely.
And I mean that in the best way. That
no, I know.
You know, just a few elements, but placed so perfectly, and that you're not trying to overcomplicate things. You kind of do it your own way. That's maybe not the technically correct way,
Absolutely.
Quote unquote. And it's about fun, right? Like all your music is fun. There's this vibe that it's not that it can't be serious too, but I think you know what I mean.
I know
that,
what you mean.
Yeah. And at least for me, you've been able to maintain that throughout your whole career and not sort of switch up your sound entirely so that it's hard to follow. You know what I mean?
I think that's honestly the open format DJ in me. You know, a lot of those guys, they've been playing, like if you've been playing other genres and stuff, you understand that simple stuff works the best. And I think I've always carried that through. And, you know, I'm not very technically diverse. I'm not the best sound designer. So I have to play off my strengths. And then that's cool about what you said about Party Favor too, because he knows how to make something that works on the dance floor.
Yep.
And not overdo it, but still just use the right tasteful amount of elements too. So yeah, I think just being like an open format DJ before, it kind of changes how your process goes and how you make stuff.
Right. What about your live shows these days? Like if you go play a giant festival in Asia, do you approach that differently than you would approach a club show here,
for example? Yeah. I definitely would play a little bit more maybe bass music stuff here.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, Asia's very caught up now with what's going on in America, so it's not too different anymore, but maybe...
Is it weird, not to cut you off, but you're big in Asia, right? Like you do a lot of big festivals.
I don't know about big, but...
Well, no, but I'm saying...
I spend the majority of my year.
Yeah.
I would say, actually, I probably tour more, maybe more there.
Sure. All I was saying is it weird to be, you know, big in Asia, the biggest in Asia, as opposed to America, whereas it used to be the flip of it, you know?
Yeah, it's a little weird, but it's just, I understand, you know, that's just the way genres and trends go. Like right now, dubstep is so big in the US, and I don't even expect to be a part of that.
Right.
And that's totally okay with me because that's just not what I do. And that's just the movement of the sounds that become hot and it becomes a cycle. And I just know at this point, you just stick it through and you know, you got to do what you got
to
do.
And this goes back to, again, what we were saying. It's if you had tried to chase the dubstep.
Yeah, imagine if I was trying to chase the dubstep sound. I was like, so that's when I made sure in 2014, at the end of 2014, when I was kind of pivoting towards a more global sound, that it was something that I was comfortable doing and it was something that was more me.
Right.
So.
Well, and I mean, a global sound.
But it's funny because people didn't know that about me. So I switched. It's like, I obviously, just look at me. I've obviously listened to a little reggae in my life. You know, it's just like, but it just made the most sense for me, man. And that's the music I truly enjoy making right now. So right now I've been working with a lot of reggae bands.
Mm.
So I've even been backstepping as far as, you know, I was able to do a song. The song with Hardwell had Mr. Vegas on it.
Right.
He's just absolute dancehall legend. And kind of, it's been on my bucket list to just kind of collaborate with these guys from the 90s and 2000s that I just loved.
No, that's so cool, man. And you also do a bit of production for other people too, right? Like pop acts, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, a little bit. I dabbled because of, you know, some of the guys that I hang out with, they're mainly doing pop now.
Right.
So like the other day I was in the studio with Sublime with Rome.
Oh, cool.
Doing some stuff.
Oh, that's really cool.
For their new single. And Yeah, man. Like,
how do you like that experience versus you being the front man artist? Like, how do you like being in the studio kind of trying to realize somebody else's vision?
I'm totally okay with that because it's kind of like my passion too. It's like, you know, I would love to work with one of the guys from Sublime.
Oh yeah.
From like, so it's, if you guys don't know Sublime with Rome, it's Eric Wilson, the original bassist, and then Rome, and they have a new drummer named Silos, who's fucking amazing. And they found, Rome was telling me the story about how he used to sleep in the studio of Eric Wilson's studio, and he played all these Sublime covers.
Okay.
And after they made a decision to keep on touring, they needed a new lead singer, and they found him from the studio because he would sleep and do engineer work at the studio.
Oh, that's cool.
But man, it was just, I'm totally okay. Just as long as I'm working with guys that I really fucking love,
yeah.
I it doesn't matter, man. It's just about, at that point, it's truly, truly about just creating good music. And I'm totally okay, you know, doing other production for other people at that point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I wasn't even trying to put a value judgment on. It's, for me, sometimes it's almost easier and more fun in a way when you don't have to put everything on yourself.
Dude, you know what? I will say that because it's kind of fresh in my mind because that was pretty recent. But yeah, we were just having a blast, man. We're in there. He's just jamming on the guitar. The guy's going in, playing the bass, recording it. I have the beats here, making 808s and whatever. It's just like, it was just what a music session should be. Just natural, just making music for music.
Yeah, more collaborative.
Yeah, very collaborative. And, you know, that's what's kind of getting me through music right now. And it's my favorite thing is just really making music with guys that I look up to. Like after I did the song on Mr. Vegas, I'm like, yeah, I'm a Mr. Vegas fan, man.
Right.
I mean, Heads High is like one of the biggest dancehall songs of like, you know, all time. And it's just like, for me to do a song with him, I was like, dude, this is so dope. And then,
yeah. And then if you can do that, what else can you do? Right.
Yeah. So then I just really enjoy collaborating with guys that have inspired me along the way, whether or not they're, you know, a lot of these acts are older acts and the kids today, the 18-year-olds today aren't listening to that. So I think like, hey, maybe I can take these guys that have inspired me and that I look up to, make music with them and share that with
absolutely
the new fans.
Absolutely, which opens the older guys up to a new audience and opens the new audience up to a bit of the history and the culture. That's a beautiful thing, man. And, you know, these days, do you have a vision for where you want to take, you know, Henry Fong, the artist? Is there the sound of it? Do you feel like you're on any particular mission right now?
I'm not really. I've kind of just been on a mission to stay inspired by working with like what we just talked about. That was my first mission, and that mission is kind of being realized right now. And I've literally, and just in the last year, I've been able to collaborate with so many dope vocalists that I've looked up to.
Mm.
Like on my last EP, I did a song with this guy, Craigie T from TOK.
Huge.
TOK is like legendary dance hall guys from, you know, 90s, 2000s. And it's like, they had so many dope records. So, and then I worked with another guy called General Degree. He's like dance hall OG. Like the guys TOK would have listened to. Like the guys TOK listened to.
Right.
And I did one with him. And then I got in studio with Sublime with Rome. And I did another one with this reggae band called Pepper on their album.
Right.
I've been a big Pepper fan. I don't know if you know who Pepper is.
I know the name, and I feel like if I heard one of the songs,
you know, like Slightly Stupid.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's that like American rock reggae scene.
Okay. Yeah.
And yeah, man, I did a song on Pepper's album that came out recently, and then I did another one with this other reggae band called Common Kings.
Right.
I just recorded one with them. So yeah, as far as like collaborations and being inspired, it's like the last like year or two has been really awesome. And it's been so organic. Like I don't have like some publisher or big label just shoving this shit down my throat. It's like, I'm going out and seeking it myself.
That's huge.
And two years ago, this was my vision. You know, I wanted to work with these guys that have inspired me and figure out how to, you know, put a twist on it. And
yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting now because I assume, you know, you're not signed to any particular label.
No.
We talked again before we started recording about your label, which maybe was a vessel for you for a while. And you were saying was a
little tough to run, but
yeah, it's a lot of time, I'm sure. But are you kind of in an independent mindset right now? Like, do you kind of want to build up what you're doing, or are you looking
to... Well, now I've spent the last like year just kind of collaborating with some of these reggae bands, some of these dancehall artists and stuff. And now I'm getting more inspired again back to the bangers. So I just kind of had to take that break and kind of fulfill my mission there, I think. And now I'm really eager to just make like dance floor bangers again. Like when I just released Rave Tool, it's like that was,
and seeing
that was
that
another
reaction.
Kind of mission realized. And just to have all these guys play my songs again, that had, because you know the stuff the last year or so has been pretty chill.
Yeah.
And it's kind of harder to get DJ support on like this, like 100 BPM tempo,
right,
as you know. So yeah, I think
what I love about what you just said too, man, is that again, it's not chasing the trends. It's, we talked earlier, we're now able to sort of see the trends and the cycles change.
Yeah.
And what I like about what you're saying is that when you saw the big trend going in a direction that didn't really mesh with you and what you did, you went a different way and just followed your passion and kind of opened up this new avenue for yourself.
Yeah.
And now you're kind of coming back, you know, meeting with the hotter sounds again as they're sort of coming back to.
Yeah, that was funny that like I didn't think, you know, at the end of 2015 that Latin music or dancehall was going to have a really big wave again or anything like
right.
that. Like I just was like, hey, let me just do something where no one's, the tempo where no one's kind of forgotten tempo at that time.
Was that stressful, or was there worry there to try to go off on your own path when you had come from this giant successful movement?
Yes and no, but I was just like, look, as long as I can just make it sound dope, maybe it'll be all right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Maybe it'll be all right. But I just was like, also like, I just kind of, I don't know, man, it just happened pretty naturally too, to be honest. I didn't sit there and it wasn't this like big planned out thing. I was just like, I'm going to fuck around with that.
Yeah. Well, you know? That's good, man. Yeah. I mean, you seem to me, you've always seemed to me as, you know, this, I don't want to stereotype you, but it's kind of the laid back, the surfer guy.
That's good.
You know, your mindset, your attitude, all of that seems to have served you pretty well. Have you had to figure out any ways for you to deal with sort of the anxieties and the stresses that this business brings?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, as you know, being in the game this long, I think the main realization that artists have is like, okay, this shit's finite, you know, like your time's going to be up and and what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And now I'm like 7 years. I'm like, God damn, man, I've been touring the world for 7 years. I was like, I had a kind of epiphany. I was like, this is crazy. It's not going to last forever. So put out the music you're going to put out, make your mark and impact and do your best to, there are guys that there's some sort of common denominator that you see with the top dogs that have made it through so many years. And I think it was truly their ability to adapt and evolve.
Yeah.
Like you see guys like Diplo and Steve Aoki in their 40s, they're still having their biggest years.
Right.
And think about how many
reinventions
and evolutions like someone like Diplo has had. And he's just always looking forward with the music.
Yeah.
And he's never looking back. And that's what I also think that I've done a little bit too, is I've never really, okay, well, maybe I look back a little bit to some of the older sure. stuff I got inspired by, but I'm never hung up on my old stuff.
Right.
And I'm not like, oh, I just need to make, imagine if I was like, I just want to make 2013 bigger and bigger forever.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, by the way, this is not like anything I've said this entire time. It is no diss against Big Room. That was like a very golden time in dance music. That was
absolutely
the most fun, short-lived time ever. It's just more of like, as a producer, going back and like beating a dead horse isn't always fun, you know?
Absolutely. And I think there's music even coming out now that I think is influenced by the Big Room sound. And I feel like
absolutely.
That's coming back around in a just slightly modified way. So there's always ways to flip it and change it and still be inspired by where you came from, but not just repeat it, you know?
Yeah. So, but yeah, back to like those guys, like, you know, in their 40s, having their biggest year still, I mean, they've just been able to evolve and stuff. And I'm like, I really love taking that mindset of just never looking back and always try to push the music forward in a new cool way. And even if that's just putting a little spin on an older dance sound that becomes recycled a little bit, but then doing it in a whole different way.
Yeah.
You know?
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it, man.
Yeah. So I think at the beginning of the year, I started, I was like, kind of felt really plateauing, like mentally or whatever. So I was just like, fuck it, I'm going to start Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Oh, there you go.
So I was like, man, I just need something else to just balance my life out. And it was just this year, because I kind of been like, at the beginning of the year, I was like, kind of didn't know what I wanted to do for the rest of the year.
Yeah.
It all finally fell together nicely, but like, yeah, so I joined Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and I kind of added that into my arsenal of activities,
right,
along with the surfing and stuff. But yeah, I just use like these different sports to really just stay level-headed. Like the Brazilian jiu-jitsu environment's really weird. It's not what anybody would think it is. It's the most respectful, like egoless thing.
Right.
Like you, like for me, and just like being this producer, like traveling around, come back, working on music. There's no rules, you know. It's just kind of just like, you know how it is. It's just very like, there's no boss telling you what to do. There's no rules.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I just felt like I needed somewhere that was had some rules.
Yeah, a little structure.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I went into this environment, and yeah, like you go in, you have to bow when you get on the mat. You have to stand in line with your ranking. It's very respectful and polite. And just having that alone is just something that's been missing from my life.
Absolutely.
So I've been using that to kind of balance with everything else. And that's mentally, I feel like that's helped keep me in check.
That's good, man. That's good. And, you know, yeah, we talked about too, like you have a family too.
Yeah.
So that's another thing you have to balance, and keeping all those balls in the air, man. It's good you're taking care of yourself mentally too, you know?
Yeah, a lot of producers, man, I hope, you know, if anyone's listening to this, they can kind of nip that in the butt before anything bad happens. And you just, it's funny, man. I want to like reach out to all these producers I see struggling mentally, and I just want to reach out with them and be like, dude, just come to like 5 Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu classes with me and I just want to help you, but I like don't know how to, like, you know?
Yeah. Well, I like that you didn't you do like a surfing tour where fans could come and surf with you during the day before the show? Stuff like that, I feel like, is...
Yeah, that's the stuff that's kind of just missing from this whole environment, you know? It's just like, even just like, it's so cool when a bunch of producers and DJs just like get to just hang out and go play basketball or something.
Sure.
And just be dudes, you know, just without the music thing on. Because sometimes these guys get into their character a little too much, like on a regular basis.
Absolutely.
It's like, yo, just go play basketball and do something like chill.
Yeah. Well, and we both know it's almost like a meme, you know, a DJ or producer will blow up and that first year they kind of turn into an asshole.
Yeah.
And then usually after that they come back down. And but it's that funny thing, man. Yeah. As much as people can avoid that at the start, the better they'll be by the end, you know?
Yeah. That's what I in jiu-jitsu, that's kind of what happens. It's like, man, you go in there as a white belt and you don't know shit.
Yeah.
And you're just getting tapped left and right. And then it really just like you surrender like a little bit of your ego, I guess. And once that ego is surrendered and everyone on the mat is on the same page, it just becomes so respectful.
Mm.
So imagine like an environment where dance music, where there wasn't these like ego-driven artists running around left and right and everybody had, you know, surrendered their ego. It'd just be the friendliest, coolest place to be.
Oh, absolutely, man.
So hopefully, you know, I think it looks like things are going in the right direction.
Yeah. I mean, that's almost like a DJ utopia you just described. I would love that, man. Yeah, because most people who do what we do are nice people. I like pretty much everybody
around. Aren't you shocked at like how many nice people that you...
But then, you know, the fame and the money and the stress and all of it get to people. And even people who I know are nice people, sometimes they, you know, are hard to hang out with. And it would be really nice if we could all kind of take that attitude. I like that.
Yeah, that would be dope. So if anyone's listening, I'm down to just kick it and go do some chill stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else you want to get out there, man? Anything else you want to tell the people before we get out of here? Anything else on your mind?
I don't know, man. My new, I put out an EP. It's out. New song, Rave Tool.
Yeah.
Is out.
What's the EP called?
It's called the Fong Island EP.
That's right.
Exactly what it sounds like. But yeah, it was just kind of just like a collection of globally influenced dance music. Like there's like a reggae song with Rome from Sublime on there. There's like a Mubatone song on there. There's a dancehall song, but it's all kind of just fun.
Yeah.
It's just fun. It's not really stuff you're going to go play in your DJ set. They're just like, hey, I just want to kind of, it was summertime, you know, I drive to the beach and go surfing on a normal day.
Yeah.
Hit the studio, and that's just, it's like kind of symbolizes like whatever I'm kind of just doing in normal life.
Dude, that's great. Fun. Yeah. Fun has a place in the DJ world, and I'd like to see.
It's like, I don't care how many plays. It's one of those things you kind of put out. And you're like, I don't care how many plays it's going to get. It's just like, I was down to, I just wanted to do it for the I guess the kind of the body of work, you know?
And mark my words, man, this is weird to say, but fun is coming back. That's my,
I hope so.
That's
dude.
My prediction for trends.
Didn't you think like dance music got like very serious and hard? It still is a little serious and hard, but like the last couple of years, like with all the heavy dubstep and stuff, but then you saw house come back.
Right.
And that kind of brought a little bit of the fun back. It reminded me when that house started getting popular, like I think last year, and it's, man, it's as big as it's ever been, maybe right now. And you just go to like one of those house shows and it's just so fun, man.
That's the thing.
Energy's so good. And
that's
just
the thing.
Some of the, and even the house songs themselves, go listen to like the Fisher or Chris Lake stuff even. Like it just has like lasers and these weird synths. Yeah. And it's kind of getting a little more left field and fun and goofy.
Yeah, goofy is a great
word. With the lasers,
man.
And all the bleeps and bloops and stuff. I'm like, this is fun, man.
It's great.
Love it.
Yeah, I want more of that, man. It's some of the new stuff I've been working on. It's not the Chris Lake Fisher sound, but it's that same attitude of just like, let's have fun again, man.
Yeah.
Because the same way you were talking earlier about not really feeling tied to one scene or one style anymore, that's where my head's at too, man. I want to get the vibe back of when I started doing this, and exactly what you're talking about.
You know those rooms where it was just that energy.
Yeah,
everyone just
super sweaty. Just everyone having a blast. Maybe you don't know every song that's being played.
Oh, dude, never.
Yeah, but you know, these days everybody knows every song.
Do you remember like back then you could like play a set and literally nobody would know one song, but it was like going off.
100%, man. And as a listener, I would love to go hear those kind of sets too. You know? Yeah, that
100%.
Was, oh, man.
Is there any DJs that you enjoyed listening to that were like, would always just play like secret bangers? You were like, yo, we got to go see so-and-so because they were always dropping secret bangers.
Yeah, for sure, man. I mean, there were so many. I mean, I came out of the rave world in the late 90s is really when I got into DJ culture and started going to shows and started DJing myself in the very late 90s. And yeah, man, I mean, I didn't know, we'd go to these raves in the Midwest and I didn't know anything anyone was playing. And it would be big name DJs. I mean, you know, I'd go see a guy like Craze when he was playing drum and bass, you know, or some of the big techno guys. Midwest was big for techno back in the 90s. So there are these kind of local legends.
House was basically invented there.
yeah, more or less, man, yeah.
And techno, kind of.
Well, yeah, I mean, techno's Detroit, house is Chicago. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's wild, right? That those two genres.
Oh my God, I think about
that
all the time.
Birthplace of that right there.
And
they're
so
kind of close to each other.
I know, dude. Yeah, physically close. And, you know, New York had disco, which...
The U.S. has a lot of regionally, like, if you broke it down by region, it has a lot of cool different genres of music.
Yeah.
Throughout, you know.
We have our own history, man. I think people forget that because, you know, same with house and techno and all of that. It was... came from here,
but it got popular.
Then it got exported to U.K. and Europe, where that's where it kind of got big. And then it sort of got shipped back to us, you know?
And that's funny.
It did come from here.
Is that funny? Now it's kind of in a place where maybe the United States is kind of dictating a little more of the trends, you know, the last couple of years. But then, you know, the UK has been listening to house and all these house records have, they've been popular in the UK for years and years and years.
They're ahead of us.
Yeah. That's, isn't it crazy? Like you, how kind of tastemaker the UK market is.
That
music.
Is insane. I mean, because I've talked with people a lot about this and I mean, they grow up with it. You know,
it's built into their, my old manager was telling me, my first manager, he was telling me like when he was little, he was just like ripping all the BBC stuff on cassettes.
Yeah.
Like listening to these like drum and bass and jungle and all this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I miss those days, man. But I think we can bring that vibe back. And it's not just us. I do think it's just another wave that's coming.
Yeah. But yeah, you're seeing it right now, man. You know, I think dance music also kind of goes through periods of hard, then it gets a little groovier and softer, and then it goes hard again. And then it's just kind of with the times, you know, people get worn out on a harder sound and then it kind of mellows out into something else. Like, you know,
absolutely.
I think that's what you saw with house right now.
Yeah. Well, the listeners are growing up and evolving with the artists.
Yeah, their tastes are evolving. And, you know, the underground stuff is becoming more applicable, I think, to everybody as they become more educated.
Yeah, 100%, man. I want to wrap up just by asking the same question I ask at the end of all of these interviews. Just looking for a memory, a time in your life when in a moment music really meant something to you, like really deeply affected you? Kind of just looking for the first thing that pops into your head.
I mean, I think it was just like that first year I really went on tour in like 2013, and I was just like playing all these like festivals and stuff. And I was just like, holy shit, I can't believe this is real, man. Like, I've never ever really took that stuff for granted, and I've always been super grateful to be able to do that. And every time I step on stage, I'm like, holy shit, I can't believe I'm doing this, man. So I just remember that first year just like stepping on some of those stages and just being like, holy shit, I can't believe music's taking me this far.
Yeah,
like it's not something I ever planned for, it's something that I just love to do so much and became obsessed with it. And I was just always forever grateful every time I step on that stage. So
that's beautiful, yeah. Man. That place of gratitude and humility. I mean, as much as we can keep ourselves there as artists, the happier we'll be.
100%, dude.
Hey, man. I can't say it better than that. This has been great, dude. Thanks for sitting down with me.
Thank you so much, bro.
All right, man. Peace. That's the show. Shout out to Henry, man. So good to talk to you. It had been too long. I hope we can do that again soon. All the new songs are crushing it. For everybody out there, don't forget, Henry Fong, Jump Up, comes out this week, this Friday, on Dim Mock Records. You got to go grab all of his recent releases. Rave Tool is out right now. The Fong Island EP before that. And there's going to be a link in the description of this episode where you can go keep up with all of his tour dates, music, everything. My name is Willie Joy. As always, you can connect with me too at Willie Joy or at Back to Back Pod. That's where I'm at on social media. Or you can hit me up directly. backtobackpod@gmail.com is the email address. I'm still buzzing. I'm still on a little bit of a high from that show last night. But I also know I'm going to crash pretty soon here too. So I'm going to sign off before that happens. I hope you have a great week. Whatever you're doing out there, whatever you're excited about, go get it. Go after it. Give it 100%. And I will talk to you next week. Take care of yourself. For Back to Back, this is Willie Joy. Peace.